Support for this podcast comes from the Central Valley Journalism Collaborative, connecting communities with the resources, infrastructure, and networks to ensure a vibrant local free press.
From KVPR in Fresno, this is Central Valley Daily. It's Wednesday, June 17th. I'm Sarith Hawk. Earlier this year, news of alleged sexual assault by Cesar Chavez sent shockwaves through the farmworker community.
He was at the top of an organization that was basically sort of allowing the abuse of women to happen and not really doing much to stop it.
One of the reporters behind that bombshell report is out with a new piece about the past culture at the United Farm Workers Union. We speak with him, but first, these headlines. The Fresno County Board of Supervisors approved June as, quote, traditional nuclear family month. The resolution passed on Tuesday in a 3-2 vote and was introduced by Chairman Gary Bredefeld.
This resolution doesn't take away anything from anyone. It doesn't prohibit anyone from celebrating holidays or any other event. It doesn't restrict anyone's rights, nor does it prevent anyone from living life as they choose.
Bredefeld says the measure is meant to recognize traditional families. The resolution defines that as a husband, a wife, and any biological, adopted, or foster children. But the measure garnered controversy because it comes in the middle of Pride Month, which recognizes people from the LGBTQ plus community. New details have emerged about a B-52 bomber involved in a deadly crash during a test flight on Monday at an Air Force base in Kern County. Tracking data, which is limited, shows the bomber made a sharp right and then turned nearly 180 degrees before falling. The plane plunged to the ground at nearly a mile a minute. All 8 people aboard were killed. The aircraft was taking part in a routine mission. It's not clear what caused the crash. California state lawmakers have passed a $356 billion budget. Lawmakers rejected Governor Gavin Newsom's plan to raise monthly health care premiums for immigrants without legal status and changes to the asset limit test for Medi-Cal eligibility. Democrat and Assembly Budget Chair Jesse Gabriel says lawmakers faced tough choices as the state faces a possible deficit in future years.
At the same time, we are also deeply centered in compassion and understanding that our state in many ways is under attack from a hostile federal administration, from folks who are intent on ripping away health care coverage.
The vote was largely ceremonial to meet the constitutional budget deadline on June 15th. Lawmakers will continue negotiations with the governor before a final budget has to be signed into law by July 1st. Officials in the city of Avenal are testing whether they can continue to hold office following a recent recall election. The group behind the recall filed an injunction last week after city council members continued to meet, defying an election that ousted them. City officials, meanwhile, maintain that the election was held unlawfully and that intervention by Kings County officials amounts to, quote, a hostile takeover of city government. The city is appealing to the state attorney general's office to deny the injunction and allow city officials to serve the remaining 5 months of their terms.
Public radio is now 100% community supported. Federal funding is gone and isn't likely to come back. That means you have the opportunity to help keep KVPR's trusted and informative coverage on the air. Do your part today and become a new monthly member. We're all in this together. Join the movement and help sustain public radio service. Donate at kvpr.org.
And now to our main story. Months after breaking the story that took down the storied legacy of civil rights icon Cesar Chavez, the New York Times reporters behind the investigation are out with a new report. This one extends beyond Cesar Chavez to the men who wielded power within the farmworker movement. At the center of the story are the women who've come forward to expose a deep-rooted culture of sexual abuse, misogyny, and silence. The piece also re-examines the role of UFW co-founder Dolores Huerta, who some women say dismiss their allegations. I spoke to Manny Fernandez, a Fresno native and New York Times California editor, about how his series of reports with journalist Sarah Hertz has forced a reckoning that's still playing out.
Yeah, I mean, when we initially started, it was about Cesar Chavez. What did Cesar Chavez do? To whom? And what could we sort of corroborate? So it was really very focused on him. But as we kept going, you know, we just sort of realized that he was operating in a universe. And so we've tried to sort of look at different pieces of that entire universe he was operating in. One example of that is we did a story of looking at La Paz, looking at the compound in the Tehachapi Mountains. And so we just started broadening it out. And we did want to look at the whole context in which he was operating in. And that's how, you know, we were just sort of led to these different women who were sort of saying, well, you know, if you're interested, I have something to say, but it doesn't have to necessarily do with Cesar Chavez. And it did have to do with him a little bit. You know, it's not like he was telling men to behave this way, but it certainly was that he was at the top of an organization that was basically sort of allowing the abuse of women to happen and not really doing much to stop it, not being very concerned when complaints did come to him. And also, I think subtly, you know, I think some of the men just had a little bit of a message that this is how we could operate. And this was the era at the time, and there were not a lot of avenues for women to report sexual assault. And so I think both like the era and that culture and the culture that he was sort of helping to sort of perpetuate, that sort of played a part in all this.
You know, the reporting took on a really difficult examination of not just the overall culture, but also of Dolores Huerta. You know, in your initial reports, we saw her shift from a labor leader to a victim of sexual assault and misogyny. But this report shows that she was also part of this culture of silencing and dismissing women and their claims. Can you talk about the process of discovering that in your reporting? How did you wrestle with that contradiction?
Yeah. You know, and it is a contradiction. You know, we were hearing from women who were telling us that Dolores Huerta's public image was not really the case, that women told us that she was not supportive, and there were things she did or dismissed that disturbed them and did not help them. And we sort of had that as a goal of trying to dig into that and learning more and going to the documents. And then, you know, I interviewed her and asked her some of these questions, you know, and she defended her record, you know, and she said, you know, I don't know why some of these women would say this, because I did support women. And we did talk to women who said, yes, Dolores supported us. So we kind of got, for Dolores, in this story, we got two sides of Dolores. We had women who were saying she was not supportive. We brought these complaints about sexism, about sexual harassment, and she didn't do enough. And then we heard from women who said, no, actually, she did help women, and I'm one example of it. So we got sort of both sides of it.
You know, much of the reporting that you have done with your colleague, Sarah, shows that the farm worker rights movement itself really took precedent over abuse and misconduct allegations. And, you know, it really calls into question, like this story did, the values of the UFW and how its treatment of women really didn't align with the mission of the union. How is the UFW kind of reckoning today with what your reports have revealed?
I think they are reckoning with it. They are wrestling with it and dealing with it. We talked to the current UFW leadership, and there are numerous women who are basically running the UFW right now. And all of these women say, this other era is completely alien to us, and it does not sound familiar. And, you know, we brought some of these cases that we were looking at and some of these allegations that were made back in the 70s. And they were stunned, and they were like, that organization then is not this one today. And they are sort of wrestling with that. I think, you know, again, we did not find any cases of current UFW participants being abused. And after our story ran, the UFW partnered with a couple of different nonprofits to give women an avenue of reporting that abuse. Basically, there's a crisis hotline, and there's some other services where any woman who says they were abused by Cesar Chavez while he was at the UFW can call, can get some services, can tell their story. They tell us that it's kept private and that the UFW is not necessarily running this. It's the nonprofit groups that are coordinating it. And so I think they are trying to sort of wrestle with, well, what do we do now? How do we show the public that we want to hear the pain of what happened? And we want to sort of figure out how to sort of reconcile all this. And so they are dealing with it. They are working through it and trying to sort of find their way. But I interviewed several women who are current leaders of the UFW, and they were just telling me how stunned they were that this could have happened back in the past.
Yeah, and that crisis hotline you mentioned, that was something that was done right after your initial report a few months ago, right?
Exactly. Yeah, it came out of that. It came out of our original story. That was one of their responses to what they could do going forward.
The reporting really has some very difficult and sensitive accounts that these women talk about. How did you approach that sensitivity to corroborate, first of all, their accounts, but also to help them sort of face this trauma?
I mean, I think if anything, we're patient. And there are some women I've talked to who have a story to tell. We've corroborated their story, but ultimately they're not ready to go public and to have their story be on the record. And that's okay. And I've just sort of politely walked away and said, when you're ready, give me a call. We have women's stories that we've corroborated that the women are not ready to go on the record. And I think that's important. And I think I don't want to rush them. I want them to come to a point where they feel like I am ready to tell my story on the record. And I think that's part of our approach, is that we've just been patient and allowed them to talk to us, get to know us, and come to their own decision that they are indeed ready. But these are very difficult conversations. I think it helps. It helps the victims to talk about it, to talk about it with us, to share their stories. We can tell them what you went through. That actually reminds me of this other person and this thing that they went through. And it's very similar. And we can sort of share what we've heard and how it matches up with what we're being told. So kind of just like talking through that, I think helps them. For a lot of these women, we're digging up, the past. A lot of these women are in their 60s and 70s talking about things that happened to them when they were very young. Mm-hmm. And they haven't wanted to talk about this. They haven't wanted to put a limelight on themselves. I think that, and especially a lot of them are Latinas, and I think that a lot of Latina women are used to not speaking out about sexual harassment, sexual assault. I think a lot of these older Latina women we're used to like, well, we don't talk about this. We keep this secret. And I think they are coming to terms with like, well, no, enough is enough. And we do need to talk about it. And I think they were inspired by the three women that we had in our original story, Dolores Huerta and Ana and Deb. I think those three women inspired other women to reach out to us and talk to us and come forward and talk about what happened to them. We've heard that they were very inspired to sort of do that. And so that's also, one positive thing that's come out of this.
Manny Fernandez, California editor at the New York Times. Really appreciate your time.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
And that's today's show. Today's episode was produced by Jonathan Linden and KVPR with support from the Central Valley Journalism Collaborative. I'm Sarith Hawk. Find the latest local news anytime at kvpr.org.
Each story you hear on Planet Money starts with a question. What happens if we refund tariffs? Why are groceries so expensive? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious, because the forces shaping our world can be hard to see. Follow NPR's Planet Money wherever you get your podcasts and start seeing how the economy really works.